Welcome to Brettonomics, a podcast series brought to you by the Bretton Woods Committee. I'm Nancy Jacklin, and I'm hosting this series about the institutions created for international cooperation in monetary and economic affairs, starting with a historic conference at Bretton Woods in 1944. We're currently looking at the institutions for cooperation and economic development, beginning at the beginning with the World Bank. In our last podcast, which began our examination of the World Bank, I introduced our expert guest, Joachim Levy. Joachim has been the chief financial officer of the World Bank, the finance minister of Brazil, and the president of the Brazilian Development Bank, and so has lots of hands-on experience with economic development and the work of the World Bank. Our first podcast on the bank looked at the principal institution in the World Bank Group, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, also called the IBRD or World Bank. We looked at how it funds itself in capital markets and lends to members for economic development. In this podcast, we will look at the other institutions of the World Bank Group, the International Development Association, the International Finance Corporation, the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Authority, and the International Center for the Resolution of Investment Disputes. We will also look at the use of specialized trust funds administered by the World Bank. So now let's talk about, we've talked about the IBRD. Let's talk about the other arms of the World Bank. There were other bodies created. You mentioned already the International Development Association, or IDA. That was created in 1959, and it was needed to provide to lower-income, less creditworthy members concessional finance, such as interest-free loans or grants. You talked a little bit about how IDA is funded compared to the World Bank. There have been more frequent capital raises for IDA. But can you talk a little bit about IDA and how it works and how it's funded?
Yeah. The IDA is geared to really very poor countries, and of course you can lend to them, but it has to be in long maturities. And in normal times, when interest rates were relatively high, it would not be affordable for these countries. So you had these low interest rates we call concessional loans, and if this means that, think when you have inflation, if you have a very low interest rate, even if people pay back the money over time, what they're paying back is worth less than what was lent, which means that for the institution to continue to operate, you have to inject new capital. In the lingo of the institution, we call this the replenishment. So for a long time, every 3 years, we'll get all the donors, all the countries together, evaluate what had been done in the last 3 years, and they would pledge and they would bring new capital so that the IDA could operate. This has changed a little bit in recent years.
Now, you were the chief financial officer at the World Bank when there really was a novel change in IDA funding. Tell us about that.
Yes, last decade, we started to tweak a bit this model. Because you remember, it was before COVID, interest rates are very low, inflation was very low, which meant that the difference between concessional lending rates and the market rates became narrower, which meant that maybe we could also raise money in the market, get external funding and not only the capital, and do what is became to be called blend these to get still very low interest rates, but in a way that we could leverage carefully the IDA. Because people did pay back all the loans over time, and there were the quite general replenishment over the decades, actually IDA had a very, very large capital basis, which meant that you could very carefully start to issue bonds. And I was very fortunate, and to participate in the first emission. It was $1.5 billion back in 2018 that were issued. And it was extremely well received by the market, by a number of institutions. And now, even with higher interest rates more recently, the IDA continues to issue a bond, the different currencies and the pound. This year, early this year, actually, IDA issued its second euro bond. It was a 20-year bond. It raised 1.75 billion euro last January. So this is say a way to increase the power of IDA together with the donations of countries. And it's important to say that the contribution to IDA comes also from middle-income countries. Not only some of these countries do direct contribution, but also part of the money raised by IBRD, the profits of IBRD, are channeled to IDA. So it's the surplus that IBRD gets by lending to middle-income countries. Part of that is reinvested in IBRD, of course, but part is donated to IDA. So it's a way to make the contributions to IDA something quite universal.
Now, sort of a very different institution was created in the World Bank Group in 1956, and this is the International Finance Corporation. And that was created to support the role of private enterprise in the development process. Why was that done, and how has IFC taken on that role as a practical matter, Joaquin?
Well, this was a very different time. Mind you, the financial markets were still very closed, rigid, still under the impact of the big recession of the 30s, the war. You think that the first euro bond was issued in 1964, so almost a decade later. So at that time, a lot of countries start to industrialize. Less developed countries start to industrialize. And there was an interest first by even multinational companies to go to these countries. But these countries didn't have that much money, and there were no markets to finance that. So IFC started helping these companies to go to these countries, bring some industrialization, which meant a huge increase in productivity for these countries. Imagine some of the first loans of IFC were for a truck factory. Imagine a truck factory in Latin America and things like this. Over time, of course, IFC started to lend to local companies in all sorts of business. And also IFC started to do something very important, which is invested in the capital basis of this company, so in equity, which was good because when a company is still at its beginning, sometimes loans is too risk because you don't know if you'll be able to service the loan at the beginning of the life. So taking this risk, making this plunge of getting equity would make a difference, big difference for these companies. And it was good for IFC. One of the most notable cases was for IFC when they invested in financial institutions in China in the late 1990s, early 2000s. I mean, with the growth of China, these institutions really, I mean, they expanded dramatically, which meant that their equity increased enormously and the investment of IFC was rewarded handsomely. And again, this was very important because IFC is exactly the other side in relation to IDA. It got, of course, initial capital from shareholders, but most of its growth has been organic. It has been thanks to the profit it makes in its operation. So this ability to invest in equity, and of course, equity has multiples that can be much higher, has helped also IFC in expanding its activities.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the issue of helping China kind of develop a private a financial sector, financial institutions. We saw in the earlier podcasts how capital markets access for emerging market countries really changed substantially in the 1990s, and I assume that did have some effect on the IFC and what it did too. Can you talk some about that?
Yes, IFC. It's like the World Bank in a way that it funds its operations in the market. They issue bonds like IBRD does. But in addition to this, when markets start to open up, they start to do funds, investment funds. It could be credit, it could be equity. But what is a fund? Basically, we'll sell quotas to investors, and you manage the money that you raise and invest. And you basically you share the results with the investors in the fund. And so the IFC in the last 2 decades has opened a lot of these funds. And why these funds are attractive to investors? Because IFC goes to places that sometimes are seen as complicated. And people will trust the ability of IFC selecting good investments. So using the contemporaneous language, investors will value the curating ability of IFC. And the recognition of this knowledge of markets, of local situations, etc., and identifying good companies and also working with these companies so that they have the highest standards is one of the biggest assets of IFC, and allow it to develop these funds and attract investors from many, many places. Now,
So you
one thing that I have to say is that more recently, IFC has been challenged to do something different than it used to do, which is to go to thinner markets, much more challenging markets, much more than just frontier markets. These are places sometimes that is very poor or has been closed or in a war, and there are few. I mean, the private sector is really underdeveloped. And there, the IFC had to adjust its model because it's really a big step up in terms of risk management to the usual operation of IFC. But of course, it responded to it.
And so the implications for the IFC of increasing these activities in much riskier countries, what are those? What how did it evolve?
Well, there are two things that made that possible. First is to continue to do what they used to do and get some profit of that. So again, for instance, IFC also does large loans to less riskier companies. And why do they do that? Well, first, because it adds value to these companies, even companies that have access to the market in developing countries. There is a reputational effect of working with IFC because people will know that you'll be implementing really high managerial standards, governance, transparency, all these things. Also, often these loans are geared to specific objectives in terms of, say, supporting women or minorities or small business. So it's a specific type of operation that is not so risky, but has a very important social or a climate content, and is very good for the reputation for this company. Now, these are bigger, so the amount of say a profit per unit of say staff of energy that we involve is larger, which leaves some money for the IFC really to go to a small operation in these small countries. So there is sort of a transfer of resources that allow the IFC to go there. The second thing.
Yeah, so I mean, really a big, it's really a diversification of the risks, right?
Absolutely, yes. And, yep. And across flows there. But the other things, even if you do all of that, which is important, it's really very sophisticated. It was very important for IFC at this stage when it was challenged to do that, which is really crucial in Africa and in other places, to tell shareholders that this is a different game. So, A, shareholders would have to be aware that they had to be ready to have bigger losses than the record in IFC. So it's more risk tolerance. This has to be well understood. And you need additional capital to back that. You cannot just do that by this portfolio composition that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And this is why, again, in 2018, we had a substantial capital increase in IFC. And from there on, IFC working together with World Bank, because often to get these things done, you need reforms, structural reforms, so that you give a better condition to the private sector. It really has expanded its activities and has gone to very interesting and challenging places.
That's fascinating. Now we have yet another arm of the World Bank Group, and this is also really linked to the private sector, and that's the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, or MIGA. And it was established in 1988 to complement public and private sources of investment insurance to cover political risks in developing countries. So why was that needed at the time, and how active has MIGA been?
Well, MIGA has been quite important, and it gives a layer of confidence to investors, because you see very often the profitability an investment, private investment, depends on the stability of the regulatory environment, the business environment around it. And if for any change, there are political changes and some rules change and so on and so forth, it's important to have some sort of insurance. And this is the type of insurance that MIGA gives. It's not traditional credit insurance. I mean, you have you took a risk and it didn't work from a commercial point of view. Well, this is not what it is doing. But together with the World Bank, using some suasion or finding other ways, they could mitigate these risks. And when there is no way around it, MIGA will compensate the company. It's interesting that MIGA over time, again, because of its knowledge and its ability also to shape outcomes, it has been able to share some of its portfolio. So to sell to other companies, private companies that do some sort of political insurance. And this has meant that by, selling part of its portfolio, MIGA could recycle its capital and increase the number of operations that is able to do. So, but it's very much again based on the trust that people, that the market has on the quality of the risk management and the ability of MIGA to establish a dialogue with authorities when there is an issue, and with that really helping the companies. Now, this is a very different type of risk, not only of the commercial risk that I mentioned, but also of, say, for instance, exchange risk. Exchange rate risk is something that would require a completely different setup. And there are institutions dedicated to that, but it's really not the core activity of MIGA. And if people wanted to use MIGA more to address this type of risk that may happen because of a crisis in balance of payments and things like these, certainly MIGA would require more capital.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the kinds of risks, just to make clear to listeners what we mean by political risks, it's, things like expropriation. It's a political decision to substantially change the tariffs on an electric power plant and business. It's direct actions by the government which affect the profitability or the operations of the firm and the investment. And those risks, a lot of countries, the U.S. has an agency that used to be called OPIC, the Overseas Private Insurance Corporation, have companies that engage in this to provide protection for their own nationals that are investing abroad, their own companies that are investing abroad. And as you said, there's a private market that's developed too, so that you can sell off part of those risks. And expand your own portfolio. So, as you said, exchange rate risk is quite different because the exchange rate changes don't come because of some discrete government action that's taken or threatened. It's because of, lots of actions taken related to the implementation of monetary and fiscal policy, as well as exchange rate management. So, we've talked about the basic operations of the World Bank and the various arms of the bank. But the bank, in addition to its just regular capital resources and borrowing, also administers a number of trust funds to provide concessional assistance. And these sums are donated by member governments or other donors to address particular concerns or objectives. They must, of course, be consistent with the World Bank's objectives and policies. Can you give us some examples of why a few of those trust funds were created and what they accomplished, Joaquin?
Oh, yeah. And actually, I mean, I couldn't help thinking that we've been discussing on the way the bank operates, mechanics of finance and so on. But I mean, the World Bank, I don't need to say it's an extraordinary institution. I mean, if you were to talk about all the projects, all the impact of these operations had in the lives of, I would not say even millions, but billions of people and places and so on. It's really quite amazing. And I think that the trust funds are an example of how also the bank can operate, and that these trust funds often will provide grants, or you provide money that could make some loans more attractive, more concessional. But usually you can think about money that the government or another institution have trust to the bank for the bank to use it and dispense along certain say general guidelines, which means that this money can be used for a number of actions, and it can have an impact in transforming reality. Sometimes you don't need a lot of money to change something, but especially if this involves a government, to get money can be really gruesome, very complicated. It's sometimes it's easier to get in a budget to get 1 billion in a program that everybody gets very excited than to do something with costs a few millions of a dozen of millions, and their trust funds can help governments everywhere, can help the bank to innovate, to show different ways of doing things. So this gives a lot of flexibility to the bank, and also it's a way for many countries to execute their foreign aid or foreign say activities through an agent that they believe they trust very much, and which has the best specialists in many area. So that's, in a way, I would say, is the spirit of the trust funds, and they are numerous. They've been set up by a number of different organizations. Sometimes one country you have several trust funds because each agent in the country would have something something special. But they really give a lot of dimensions to the bank.
Yeah, so for pilot projects, and as you said, for smaller kinds of operations where you don't want all of the kind of architecture around making a large substantial loan, this can kind of let the World Bank be a little bit more fleet of foot in helping countries out in innovative ways. Now, the use of the trust funds, though, and their proliferation hasn't been without controversy, has it? Tell me some about that.
Yeah. See, as with everything, governance can be a concern, but in several ways. One, some may think that this being, say, resources set up by individual countries or individual organizations, well, they are bypassing the general governance of the bank, and you might have undue influence of one country or another. Well, some people claim that. Not obvious that this happens. The other thing is that, well, you may give too much leeway to staff in using these funds. Sometimes the rules, on the operation of the fund are relatively flexible. So you could people think that maybe they might or might not be aligned with the bank's objectives and so on. Again, I don't see that being a major problem. But yes, there's sometimes there is this concern about the governance, and some people even think that no, we should put all this money under just in one big pot and take there with very specific rules and so on. As in so many cases, you have to balance the flexibility with the governance. And you see, I do believe that this flexibility is very important. And also, the flexibility gives to staff, and this freedom can be very, very important. The bank has really bright people, people extremely committed, people that have built a trust in many countries. So to allow these people to have access to some money to address things quickly, show things that work and so on, is very often extremely valuable for the bank. It's really a way to leverage its human capital. So, of course, you need to measure outcomes. You need to have a governance. But I think that my experience, my personal experience in different positions has been that in general, these funds can be very effective, and they cover all sorts of things.
Now, tell me some of the ways these funds have been used.
Well, they often can help, for instance, to introduce either, for instance, research of what works and doesn't work in education in a country. And then you can have, like you mentioned, a pilot in a new innovative way of having education or energy. Let's start a saving program, energy saving program, or how you can, measure efficiency of certain appliances or whatever. There are millions of questions. I will mention one thing that my personal experience almost 20 years ago, the Brazilian Treasury was responsible of, ensuring that we could meet all the fiscal responsibility goals, but also get public investment in what is essential to happen, because you need some level of public investment. But how you pick up, how to ensure the efficiency, the cost benefit, so on. So with the help of the World Bank and some money from Trust Fund, we set up a unit that later, after I had gone, did wonderful things and helping selecting public investment. So I sometimes I joke that this was a small step for those teams, but a big leap in terms of improving the quality of spending, which is one of the most important things. And also, I think more recently, for instance, during the pandemic, having the trust fund was very helpful to scale up some things to ensure that you got money to address quickly and some things, either well, vaccine, but before that, other things. So the mobilization of resources in 2020 was another example of how trust funds could help, especially for very poor countries, either countries and so on. So yes, governance, yes, accountability, but let me say something just to finish. You call it trust funds because countries trust this money or the bank to disburse. But they say they are trust fund also because they do help the bank to build trust with their counterparts, especially government, local governments, and so on. Because when you have a good specialist, a good, committed, high-quality team involved with a counterpart, and they can show that they can mobilize the resources to make a difference, that's really a way to build trust and also to create new operations for the bank. Because after something works fine, you can scale up, you can replicate.
Yeah, no, that's a terrific practical perspective for us, Joachim. Thank you so much. One institution we have not discussed yet in the World Bank Group, which I will briefly mention, is the International Center for the Resolution of Investment Disputes, which is another body like the International Finance Corporation and the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency that fosters private sector investment and economic development. ICSID, as it is known, does this by providing an impartial forum for resolving disputes between member states and their foreign investors. Well, thank you again, Joachim, for giving us a real sense of why each of the institutions in the World Bank Group was created, what they do, how they're involved with a changing economy and changing financial markets. You have also given us valuable practical insights on the role of trust funds as a way to meet development financing needs of members in a flexible and pragmatic way. Our third and final podcast on the World Bank Group will explain how and why the World Bank is not just a financial institution, but also is a knowledge bank. How it relates to its Bretton Woods sister institution, the IMF, and what the World Bank's expanding role is in the current era in addressing the challenges to economic development posed by climate change. Please continue with us as Joachim and I have more to explore.